He's a lovely guy.
He's really nice.
A very good golfer.
He's really nice.
And like, you wouldn't necessarily guess it. Like a lot of very good golfers have kind of got a swagger.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But he's so kind of body language is so kind of reserved. He must be. I mean, if he wanted to, he could hustle all sorts of people, I think, on a golf course. But, yeah,
Sunningdale's a dream, though. You'd have to talk me through that process.
Well, it's complicated.
Right. Okay. We'll save that for another time.
Yeah. It's not easy, actually.
I've heard.
But yeah, you've got to put some effort into it.
The Berkshire is pretty close to home, actually. It's probably 15 minutes, 20 minutes.
Yeah.
So that is an ambition. Yeah. The problem is at the moment the kids are small. So and the Castle Royal's got kind of a health club and a gym and a crash and swimming, and so it's very inconvenient.
Yeah.
The golf course is decent, to be fair. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
But it doesn't really pull my heartstrings.
Yeah. I'm not really a Beaverbrook or Queen
type. I only said that in jest.
No.
We've got some people here, haven't we, that are members of
don't know, actually.
Queenwood's a great golf course.
Gatehouse is a member of Swinney Forest, and that would be the dream.
Yes, lovely. Yeah.
He's a member of that ridiculous French golf course as well that you can only get into if you're virtual royalty.
Montfontaine.
That's where he's a member. His father-in-law's a member.
Yeah. And then a bunch of my Valderrama buddies are all Montfontaine guys. The French, clique. Yeah, apparently amazing. Yeah.
And did you watch the Bears on Sunday, or was it not on live?
No.
It was on live, was it?
Well, I've got Game Pass.
Okay, you got
so
that.
So I, you know, my son and I, we have the Bears on the iPad, and Red Zone on the kind of main.
I mean, they were game. They were 17-0 down.
Yeah, we were shit. Yeah, we were. The offense was absurdly bad. It's very Bears, actually.
Where did your passion come from?
My dad, he did quite a lot of business in the US, like back in the 80s. And he had a client who visited us, and he gave me a Walter Payton jersey.
Did he? And that was it.
And my brother a Dan Marino jersey. And it was the year before the great 85 Bears team. Mm-hmm. And it was like just coming on British TV. And Channel 4 those days, wasn't it?
Sky do a brilliant job of it.
Yeah. He's brilliant. Neil Reynolds, actually, and the whole team. And Game Pass is brilliant, like for the highlights the next day, and if you want to watch your team. So. Yeah, well, I'm in pretty deep. Mm. We went and saw a game actually in Chicago last, whenever the October half term was.
Yeah,
tortured my kids.
Soldier Field.
And we're going there at Spurs actually.
But it's such an event, isn't it? It's not just going to watch the football. It's everything else that comes along with that.
Yeah,
and particularly
the NFL, because there's only 17 games. So there's only 8 or 9 home games. Course. It's not like you support Arsenal and you can go 25 plus times.
No, I hadn't thought of that, actually.
Yeah, so it's an event.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, there's 8 games at Soldier Field.
And I think that less is more.
Definitely.
Like, to come back to golf, I mean, there's a lesson in professional golf, isn't there?
Yeah.
A bit less is more.
Yeah, yeah.
Football is maybe bleeding itself dry a little bit with too many tournaments.
Well, I can't believe that every year the Premier League starts again. It just feels like it's still the summer.
Well, and that's the cool world. I'm biased, but... Once the NFL comes round, you're like salivating because it's been like 7 months. Such a physical sport. The off season's so big. So, and the rosters change a lot every year. Mm. So, you know, it's not just going to be Man City again.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, there's all sorts of teams.
Yeah. That's one of the benefit of it. Yeah.
So, but anyway, we won. That'll do.
Super. Should we get cracking? Got a thumbs up from Alex. Good. Dave, welcome. Good afternoon, everybody. Taking stock after the bell, episode 38, he says. A couple of weekend editions hitting soon. Delighted to be joined by Dave Mortlock, Managing Director of Berenberg. Dave sent us his very extended biog, which said 25 years working in the city, Schroeder and Citigroup, joined Berenberg in 2010 to build the investment bank, became managing partner in 2020, the first non-German to hold the role in the bank's 434-year history. So they've got 150-odd years on Courtauchievea. We've only got 255 years of history. And aside from that, as we were just discussing, Dave's big Chicago Bears fan, the NFL, and is also a very keen golfer. So welcome to the party.
Good that must have been on. Quite something being made partner after
yeah,
that history. That is phenomenal.
Yeah, it was a big moment, like for me and the bank actually, and you know, credit the shareholders for inviting me. There's obviously a ton of history. It's interesting, Berenberg's older than the US as a country. Yeah, yeah. And there's been more presidents of the US than there have been partners of Berenberg.
Blimey.
39, and Christian, who is at the same time as me, is number 40. So, yeah,
so what is some of the history of Berenberg then? Where did it sort of, because it must have come out of the old Germanic empires.
Right? Yeah, how long have we got to cover 400 years? It was the Elbe, so the kind of tributary that goes down through Hamburg in northern Germany. It was obviously a big shipping hub.
Mm-hmm.
So it originated, I think, it was kind of shipping finance kind of based, and very much a family bank. Yeah, and then it's evolved through the kind of centuries. Now we're, you know, mid-size. We've got an investment bank, wealth and asset management business, and a corporate bank. So about 1,700 people. Wow. So yeah, there's a book if you ever want to read it.
Yeah.
But there's some interesting history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's amazing. And do you get over there much?
Not as much as I did actually. I there's generally a trip or two to Hamburg every year and Frankfurt.
Mm-hmm.
But actually pre-COVID, tended to go more. Hamburg's a great city if you've never been.
No, I haven't.
Whether it's summer or winter, it's a really pretty place actually.
Oh, cool.
So it's fun to visit.
And from the UK side, obviously the part of the business you run, is that predominantly sort of highlighting the opportunities of UK companies to US investors, European investors, or you cover European stocks as well, but I'm guessing the German bank does that.
Well, I mean, so there's three of us who run the bank. So we kind of straddle all three of the businesses. My focus is on the investment bank.
Mm.
So I'm not personally, specifically just UK. You know, we've got an office in New York and across Europe. But we, you know, the HQ of the investment bank is London, down the road, next to the Bank of England. We've got 350 odd people. We cover about 300 stocks in the UK.
Okay.
And we were building that corporate broking business. So we're becoming much more relevant in the UK. Yeah, so we cover everything down from Vodafone and AstraZeneca all the way down to kind of small caps in the UK within the equities business. And then obviously a lot of stocks in Germany and across Europe as well.
It's fascinating.
Great. Chicago Bears fan, does that make you bearish or are you somewhat more bullish?
Thought about it like that. Well, this basketball team is the Bulls.
The NFL, the NBA.
I'm naturally hedged. It depends what we're talking about. I mean, as on bonds right now, bullish. On equities, probably less so.
Mm-hmm.
But there's lots of caveats, you know, within that, depending on region and sector and you know, market cap spectrum. You know, so that and I think you guys have been familiar with my view in recent kind of months and years. I see a lot of opportunity still in fixed income markets, particularly at the kind of sovereign level. But you know, the key question right now is where are economies headed?
Yeah.
What does that mean for earnings? And then, you know, equity markets, as we know, discount earnings in advance. What does that mean for share prices? So. And I'm a little bit more worried about growth generally, I would say. I'm not bearish, you know, and I can completely understand the soft landing scenario, but...
They're pretty rare.
Yeah, if I had to tilt one way or the other, I'd be a bit more worried about growth. I don't think we're headed for something nasty a la, you know, 08-09, but I worry about growth next year.
There's quite a lot priced into... kind of US earnings next year again, aren't there?
Yeah, I mean, the interest, I mean, from my, again, I'm not a strategist or an economist, but from my cursory analysis of US earnings, have actually been pretty flat for the last couple of years at the S&P level, and yet they're going to inflect up 15%+ next year. Intuitively, that doesn't feel necessarily right to me, given where we are in the cycle, given that labour markets are softening, and given where interest rates still are. So I'd be sceptical of GDP growth and earnings forecasts 2025. I'm not saying they're going to be wrong by a huge delta, but given that I'm skeptical there, again, equities as an asset class, I think might struggle to make much headway, but there will be opportunities within
those. That's the key, isn't it? Is there are still opportunities there in certain stocks.
Just on the macro then, this is always quite, I haven't used this before actually on the pod, but the Citigroup did an economic surprise index. So we've got the blue line here is the US, the yellow line is Eurozone, UK is in grey. And basically what it shows is how the economic data is coming relative to expectations.
Yep.
So analysts and strategists have their views of, you know, inflation tomorrow is going to be 3% or unemployment is going to be 5%.
Yep.
Is it better or worse? So a line going down here means that the economic data is generally coming in worse than people expected. And it's sort of a mean reverting series, which might not mean as much to people, but you know, essentially it kind of oscillates around zero. But what it does quite clearly show is that the data out of the US in particular, blue, and the US, you know, effectively drives a global bus in financial markets, is negative and has been negative for a good 6 months or so, meaning that the data out of the US has been deteriorating relative to what people thought. So that comes back to your point about, you know, the economy doesn't perhaps seem quite as strong as it has done. Interestingly, the one on this chart that does jump out a little bit is the UK, which of course, as we've mentioned in the preamble, before we started press go, actually looked pretty good. And we've had another set of decent labour market data this morning out of the UK. So there is that sort of backdrop of, you know, slightly softening economic growth. Unemployment in the US and UK, UK in blue this time, US in yellow, is ticking higher. Wage growth is moderating down at the sort of fives. And US manufacturing, the ISM, or the Institute of Supply Management's headline manufacturing index, has also deteriorated a bit. So anything sort of stand out there in terms of, I mean, they are kind of not going the right way, but they're not necessarily flashing red if you sort of look at the
data. I don't think anything's flashing red particularly right now, apart from China on a kind of broader level. You know, it was interesting that surprise chart, looking at it, the US generally leads. So, you know, if you look back there over the last kind of 12 months, it tends to lead the UK and Europe, where the US heads, generally the UK and Europe do as well. But undeniably, you know, the last kind of 3 or 4 months of US data broadly has been weaker. Again, I wouldn't say anything particularly alarming within that, you know, and equity markets generally have taken that as good news right now, because it means the Fed is going to be able to cut rates, which should, you know, breathe some oxygen back into kind of funding markets again. But yeah, and I think UK and Europe have got their own issues. I would be more bullish on the UK right now. But generally, a lot of the data, it's either deteriorating or knocking around at kind of reasonably depressed levels. I would say, and I struggle to see the catalyst why it's going to reinflect higher
at this point. So the market is expecting some pretty aggressive rate cuts. So the chart here is what the futures curve is telling us, or the market's best guess of US policy rates in blue versus 3 months ago in red. So the last 3 months, as that data has deteriorated, as we mentioned with the surprise indices, you know, the market is now expecting rates to fall by the best part of 1% by the end of this year. So the market's betting 4.5 on the Fed funds rate. So quite aggressive moves lower, and a much lower terminal rate, as we call it, i.e. the long-term kind of average rate of 3%. So the market is kind of hopeful, I guess, does a kind of 3-3.5% Fed funds rate correlate with decent growth and decent earnings growth for equities? I guess that's the question, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I mean this all really, you know, when you backtrack in recent months, it was that, you know, July payrolls number that really kind of changed everything. We've, you know, because everyone's, a lot of the other data in the US has been pretty mixed, but payrolls have actually held up really well. And again, I was kind of expecting a soft payrolls print at some point, and you're kind of ticking the months off where it was all very much in line. The July number was the first kind of really weak print that we had in the US. That's when Fed futures curve started to move, the US 10-year treasury yield really started to move, and the dot plot, as it's called, in terms of where people, you know, expect, you know, forward Fed rates to go. And I think you can kind of all back it to there. I think all the labor market data in the US we've had since is kind of supportive, again, of a softening, nothing flashing red. Mm. But you can understand why expectations of Fed cuts has certainly grown over that kind of 6-week period. And I think, you know, that we're now in this window now where economies are holding up well. Generally, the data doesn't look terrible, but it's kind of now a race between, can the Fed cut to support
quick enough?
Yeah, or are they going to end up panic cutting at some point?
So what the Fed does in the middle of September, whether they do a half point or a quarter point, makes pretty much zero difference to most of our clients, long-term investors, right? But at this point, it's kind of fun to talk about. So do the Fed go 0.5% in the December, in the September meeting, or do they, typically quite a cautious institution?
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the language recently suggests 50 basis points.
Yeah.
And I it wouldn't surprise me if they did 50, just to kind of make a statement.
Do you think that will spook the market though?
That is that a panic cut?
I'm not sure. You know, again, if you back up to that, you know, when the July payrolls came out, I can't remember which Friday it was in August, people were starting to call for intra-meeting cuts.
I remember you put in your blog.
It was mad.
And for the listeners, Dave does a brilliant blog, sort of once a month or so, and it's the information on it is. Excellent, but you just told everyone to calm down, basically, which I thought was superb.
I think, you know, I'm 25 years in this. I'm just about remember the kind of tech bust in 2000 through 9/11. Mm. I remember vividly still the financial crisis. There are times when intra-meeting cuts are required. Mm. This isn't it.
No.
You know, and I think there was quite a lot of hysteria out there, and rightly they stayed put and let things play out. Yeah. So I think whether it's 25 or 50, I'm sure Jerome Powell, the language around it will be appropriate to kind of keep markets calm, and we see what they do. I think whether it's 25 or 50, I think the cut thereafter is probably the opposite. Mm. I think if I were best guess, so they'll either do 50 then 25 or 25 then 50. I still think they'll do 75 bips between now and year end. Yeah. But I think that type of quantum feels appropriate, unless the data through September into October gets markedly worse. Sure. You know, and again, I think that really they're tuned into, you know, we can talk about inflation. Really, inflation's done. And, you know, most of the drivers of it, in my view, are done. Really, they're looking at the labour market.
It's funny you say that. Sorry, Hughes. It's funny you say that, because this must be the first podcast that we've done that I've not got an inflation chart.
I was going to, I mean, the US, that feels right. In the UK, and then there's some clients that have specifically been asking about this, is sort of the growing power of unions. And I think our client, you know, our clients typically are a bit older and definitely remember the 70s.
Yeah.
Do you think that's a real, do you think that is something we should be worried about, or do you think no?
No, I respect everyone's view, and I may well be wrong, but you know, the three things that I think categorise the 70s on the inflation front were, one, hugely more powerful trade unions, and whatever the incoming government do, or governments across Europe, we're miles and miles away from how labour markets were structured back in the 70s. Two, there was just a complete absence of any productivity growth in the 70s at all. It was obviously heavy industry, now we live in a much more kind of tech and science-based or much more balanced economies. So productivity growth generally is way north of what it was back then. And third, energy. You know, again, the 70s was characterized by a very concentrated oil market that was prone to oil shocks. So you had these huge inflationary bursts from an oil price perspective. Mm. It's one of the last charts I was just looking at before I came here, actually. You know, Brent you know, WTI is in free fall right now in terms of an oil price. The oil prices can, the oil markets are oversupplied, frankly, and fractured. So I don't really see this as 1970s. And again, the fourth point probably to make is just demographics. History tends to teach you that when demographics are heading in the opposite direction, you don't really get that much inflation in terms of inflationary environments. Obviously, in the 70s, we had all the boomers and population growth. You know, I think Western world populations are forecast to peak sometimes in the next 20 years. Japan's a good example. Really bad demographics, no inflation now to speak of for pretty much 30 years. So you put all that together, I can understand why a lot of the headlines, you know, of the last 18 months would cause people who were old enough to be reminded of the 1970s. But I don't see it as an outcome at all. And again, even if you look at, again, not to go on about oil, we've had big OPEC cuts and we've got war, and still the oil price is 65 and in free fall.
For those of us in the UK, and actually you mentioned you looked at the oil chart, I actually did an oil price chart. We're not going to put it up on the screen because I haven't but this is the oil chart here in the top right hand corner. Yeah. Sterling, it's as low as it's been in 3 years because sterling's gone up as well as the oil price fallen. Yeah. So if anyone's looking for a kind of an outside tip on what might be in their budget, the fuel duty escalator might come back on the basis that fuel prices in the UK have fallen a lot. And there's definitely some scope there to raise some more money. This is really good news for consumers.
You look into next year, I mean, OPEC have cut a lot, so they're kind of itching to add supply. Yeah. Non-OPEC supply looks like it's going to exceed any increase in demand. Again, if you're slightly worried about growth, which I am at the margin, any Ukraine resolution, I think markets discount in advance. They tend to, but this and again, I'm a reasonable believer in this kind of super abundance theory. There's a lot of scare stories written about how much oil was left. There's more oil and gas reserves available to the human race right now, I think, than there ever has been.
We're better at using them as well. We're way more efficient.
Yeah, and we're also trending away as a general rule from petrochemicals. So, again, oil demographics, labour market structure, productivity. This question, is inflation embedded? I don't think it is. I think it was transitory coming out of COVID. Mm. It just lingered longer than generally people expected. Mm. Is my view.
Are you concerned that the Fed hasn't and Bank of England haven't cut soon enough? Because the view is it takes 18 months to feel the impact of a hike or a cut. Do you think it's a bit late? Or
I think at the margin, both the ECB and the Bank of England might have moved earlier and bigger. Look, being a central banker is a very difficult job. And I think, as you know from reading my blogs, I've generally been really supportive, actually, of certainly Jerome Powell and Andrew Bailey. It's a tough job. Coming out of COVID was a very extreme situation in terms of demand versus supply. Mm. You could well argue whether rate increases were going to change that anyway. I think now that the data coming in, I think they're all on the right page. I think it's at what pace now do they start cutting, but I'd be surprised if we look back 12-18 months that it wasn't solidly down. It's just at what pace that happens, which is the question.
You touched on China very briefly, and I wasn't going to ask you about it, but the data looks horrible in the short term. They've got property crisis bust, equivalent to essentially what the US, as far as I can tell, went through in 08 in terms of property price blowing up. Mm. Demographics look horrible and we've got a lot of debt. Yep. I mean,
and commodity prices. Consumers are not spending.
Because they're, petrified.
Yep.
Is that short-term weakness? Chinese assets are very cheap. Chinese equities in particular are very cheap. Is that a value trap, to use a sort of market phrase, or is there actually genuinely value there, or are the structural issues way too big?
I'm not a China expert. From my distant view, I wouldn't go anywhere near Chinese equities for the reasons you've just listed and others. I'm not sure the political direction of travel is particularly favourable for private commerce and markets over there right now. So I know Chinese markets have been a horror show performance wise, but the smart emerging market people that I talk to, you know, we've had the kind of China era. You know, everyone keeps talking about India to me in terms of, again, more supportive demographics, more, you know, people offshoring now tend to be headed to India more than China, particularly as economies have tilted towards technology and science. So, again, I'm not an EM expert at all, but I wouldn't be buying into weakness from China.
It doesn't look great, but the only bull case seems to be no one wants to buy them and everyone's bearish, which is a bull case to a degree, but I don't know. We'll kind of have to wait and see a little bit.
I'd rather buy the UK, where you could, you know, which is a bit of a forgotten market globally, actually.
Well, the valuation's the same, right? And if you get a lot of resources out of the UK, so there's an element of that kind of worry about commodities a little bit.
Yeah.
But if China doesn't fall over properly and commodity prices are cyclically depressed, the UK does quite well.
Yeah.
And again, in the August kind of meltdown that we had, it wasn't really a meltdown, but a bit of hyperbole, doesn't harm anyone. Like, the UK performed pretty well.
Yeah.
And it performed very well in 2022 when war in Ukraine kicked off. So, you know, my view is the UK, all right, it's not going to excite anyone. Do we have any Apples or Nvidias? Yeah. No. Shell and Glaxo. But it does something in a portfolio alongside other equity assets, and it's pretty cheap.
I mean, I think it's ironic in the UK at the moment that we've replaced a government that was desperately trying to be positive on the UK, but the backdrop was just relentlessly negative post-Brexit and through all of the, you know, the Liz Truss budget and all the kind of prime ministerial changes, lots of own goals. And it's been replaced by a government that's now trying to be actually quite bearish on the UK. So they can kitchen sink some stuff early, raise some more tax revenue and fill the coffers. But actually the narrative out there in the UK, the people that I speak to in the UK, but also in Europe and the US, is getting more positive. And I think we're headed into a kind of a more glass half full era as Brexit kind of washes through. A lot of the UK data has held up well. The UK still has quite a lot going for it. The equity market looks really cheap. Mm. So you can cut, you know, amongst international investors, we're certainly sensing a lot more interest in UK equities than any other time.
Do you think part of that is, obviously the US has had a very good run.
Yeah.
And part of it is sort of taking some money off the table there and looking elsewhere.
Yeah, I think partly that. I think partly the valuation of UK equities looks cheap. I do think partly a kind of change of government, actually. I think, you know,
we had to have something.
Yeah, a kind of catalyst, whatever your view politically.
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of international investors that just did not like the prior government and were kind of, you know, worried about what might come next. And that, again, I feel like that pendulum has been swinging. And then, you know, almost not a week goes by without good UK companies, you know, getting delisted and taking private, which again shines a light, I think, on valuations in listed UK equities. They look very cheap. And I think everyone just got too bearish on the UK as an economy, as a country, through the whole Brexit process, and forgot that there's still a lot going for, you know, UK as an economy and as a country. So I don't know, I feel like that narrative's beginning to change to the positive, actually.
I agree, and what sort of worries me a little bit about the Starmer, Rachel Reeves kitchen sink strategy, to want of a better phrase, is that, you know, this idea that things are going to get worse before they get better. It's a little bit, if people are increasingly positive, and as you say, international investors are increasingly keen, to use your words, then there's a risk actually that they put them off a little bit and that business doesn't go ahead and take out that loan and build that factory, or that global fund manager doesn't allocate another 2% of his portfolio to UK equities.
Yeah.
And these things all make quite a bit, you know, at the margin, do make a difference, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I everything's relative, you know, and if you look at what's going on politically across Europe at the moment, you know, France, I feel like the UK's handed over the kind of baton a little bit in terms of political uncertainty, which we've been carrying for a while. Yeah. Mercifully feel like we've handed it over to France. I think that's got some pretty big issues politically in years to come. You know, there's a big debate around Germany and you know, deindustrialization, and obviously politically there seems to be a lot of shifting sands as well right now. So I think, you know, I think my personal view is Reeves and Starmer are doing what they need to do now in order to raise money, make sure that we're well capitalized. I'm not a huge historian, but I think that's pretty much what Margaret Thatcher did in her first couple of years in power, actually. If you track back. So I think it's not without its sense, so long as there's a balance, you know, to the language they use.
And there is the potential, and hopefully it's being done, is us leaning, I think, more on an industry by industry basis, but getting slightly closer to the European market again, as much as we can without a deal happening, but actually manufacturers and suppliers talking to each other and saying, look, there are ways around this. And that, I'd like to think that happens a bit more. And if you go back to Brexit, when Brexit happened, you know, some people said it would take 10 years to sort out this mess. And I think at the time, I think everyone, we all thought 10 years is a very long time. It can't take that long. And we are almost 10 years, aren't we? And it's taken that long.
But I think that's why, you know, I if you look at a sterling euro foreign exchange chart, it's been stuck in this 105 to 120 range for basically 4 or 5 years. Yeah. It's right at the top of that range right now. Yeah. And it, again, I'm not an FX expert, but if I had to make a call, I would bet that it breaks out higher. And I think one of the reasons for that, and one of the reasons for the strength of sterling in the last few months, is the change of government here probably gives way to now a sequence of kind of mini deals with the EU.
The boring stuff.
Yeah, that you can't write down now or anticipate. But you would now the party that kind of enacted Brexit is gone, and there's a lot of water under the bridge. I would imagine there'll be a sequence.
I think this for me is actually, you've hit the nail on the head, which is so I've got a client in an industry, and he's kind of like a middle-sized business. And when Brexit happened, I think he thought things were going to be quite difficult because he was a big importer of food. Yep. He said, actually, what's happened is all the marginal small players that were basically nicking 50 quid here and there can't do it anymore. So they've all been knocked out. And actually, the people that want to do business properly, they've either set up factories in the right places, or they've just worked within the rules. And actually now there's better business being done because there's not people jumping in the middle. And it's, again, as a buyer of, you know, I'm a big cycling fan. If I want to buy Shimano something, actually I used to buy it from Europe probably, but you can't do it anymore because of the customs duty. So now you're buying from a proper UK business that has a deal with, you know, Shimano Japan, and we're importing it properly. So I think it has taken this long to sort out, but proper business is starting to get done again, and there are deals within industries, and we're seeing that from the profitability of some of the UK businesses we're invested in.
Businesses find a way generally. And again, it takes time to do. But, you know, everyone can debate the impact of Brexit on the UK. And I've no skin in the game. It looks less than generally is written up by a lot of the press. But I'd be surprised now if there wasn't a sequence. I mean, it looks like, you know, free movement of under 30s. Yeah. You know, It feels to me like that now that the kind of tension is gone and the people who were in the room are kind of gone and there's a new government.
That's
here.
A very fair point.
It feels to me like there'll be a common sense kind of sequence of deals on who knows what and when, and I have no idea, which should, again, be supportive of a more positive kind of narrative on the UK economy.
That'd be handy for your trips to Spain and use these Mallorca cycling trips. I've only got one golf trip, but we're going to Ireland, actually, Donegal, going into Rossapenna. I sidetrack. Bonds, you mentioned you're keen on bonds still. I mean, you've got a chart here, 10-year yields, UK in blue, US in yellow, and Germany in grey. After the, you know, tumultuous period of 2021 to 2022, when it went from 0 to 5, Liz Truss' budget is just there at the start of the chart, you can see. Yeah. Settle back at the lower end of the kind of 3-year range now. So UK 10-year, US 10-year, both now below 4%. Yep. you know, we've talked a lot on the pod, James and I, with various guests about how us managing portfolios for individuals in particular,
yeah,
it's been a sea change where we had 10 years where we basically, we could buy bonds, but it wasn't a point buying bonds, yeah, because you weren't getting any return.
Yeah.
Now bonds are a genuine, you know, asset class that we can invest in again. If we have cautious clients, we can come in and give them some yield and some return that's, yeah, relatively low risk. You know, when bonds start sort of dipping below 4% and we talk about, you know, sort of bullish on bonds, how sort of low do we think, you know, where does that settle back in the context of kind of post-financial crisis history?
Well, let's track back to the beginning of the year-ish. You know, when the US 10-year yield hit 5%, there were a lot of people calling for it to go to 7.
Yeah.
Yes. So that, and I, you know, I don't want to pat myself on the back too much, but I was very consistent in the stuff that I was sending out.
Yeah, 100%.
Essentially describing it, I thought, as a generational opportunity, yeah, to buy risk-free assets at a 5% yield in advance of probably a slowing economy and inflation, again, which was a big debate earlier this year. Where is inflation going? A lot of people thought it was going to re-inflate up to 7-8%. Yeah, sort of it hasn't, which to me was, and to a lot of others, was pretty obvious. So, you know, that move already has been big for, you know, one of the biggest markets in the world, the US 10-year. You know, is it as obvious at 3.6% yield as it was at 5? No. But I still think on a multi-year view, I think it's more likely that we're going to trend back, not to the last cycle in an identical manner, as in no inflation, no interest rates, pretty much zero yield. But I still think we're probably going to end up in a place where we're more likely to be talking about QE rather than QT at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Not soon. Again, given demographics and levels of debt and everything else. So I would still be a buyer of, you know, these yields, as I said at the outset, of gilts and treasuries. Where they go to will be a function of, again, everyone talks about, you know, term premium and lots of kind of technicalities within bond markets. But in essence, for me, if growth is slowing, if interest rates are falling, and if unemployment's ticking up, you want to be long sovereign bonds, in my view.
Yeah.
So I think those yields on a kind of 12 to 24 month view, I'd be surprised if they don't head lower still.
Well, you start the year with your 4%, don't you? So like when you're buying a bond at 1%, you don't have much margin for safety if yields go up.
Yeah.
Whereas if yields go up by 0.5% from 4%, you don't necessarily lose money, do you? You just perhaps don't make as much as you would otherwise have done. So there's definitely much more margin of safety. And, you know, broadly speaking, we have a lot more bonds for clients than we have done all my career, pretty much, which is pretty much.
Well, being able, as we said before, being able to lock in these returns with low coupons for individual taxpayers, you know, they're not paying. Obviously, the capital return, there's no tax on it. The income tax on a low coupon is very low. So you gross up the return and you're almost at 7, aren't you? So
It shows how unexciting my life as a fund manager is. One of my most exciting trades was buying a 3-year gilt the week after the Liz Truss budget at kind of 4.75% yields.
Yeah, I mean,
what
I
a hero, eh?
Did you? Yeah. I bought a 61, the 0.5% 61.
Double your money.
Yeah.
Well, the moral of that story for me, when I was a junior broker 25 years ago, you know, these bits of advice stick in your mind that all the kind of seniors provide you. I can't remember who it was said to me, always buy markets when they're moving on political stuff. So, you know, that the whole Liz Truss thing, you know, would be a great example.
Yeah.
Actually, post the French election,
you
know, when the CAC 40 was getting sold off heavily, and French bonds were getting sold off heavily, that you generally markets near term overly discount political anxiety. And it tends to be a kind of good opportunity if you track back, you know, through history.
Yeah,
a lot of the moves when Donald Trump was elected first were quickly kind of unwound.
Well, the S&P nearly didn't open, did it?
Because it was down 5% in the after hours, and then it was up heavily. The one I remember is the TARP vote, wasn't it, 2008?
Yeah.
TARP or TAF, whichever one it was that they threw out. And they didn't get through, and the market dumped thousands of points in those days. The market wasn't even, you know, the Dow probably was only in four figures in those days.
Yeah.
That was a pretty good generational buying opportunity, wasn't it?
Yeah. You talked about, you mentioned demographics and also debt. Is the US debt pile to be worried about? Or is one of those, you only worry about it when it becomes a problem?
Well, there have been academics who've written papers on this, but really, debt only really becomes a big problem if people lose faith in the currency.
Yeah.
The pair go hand in hand. So really, the absolute stock of US debt looks scary if you track it back since COVID and since 2008.
Yeah.
It's still way less as a percentage of the US economy than Japan. There's a kind of data point out there that you could suggest US debt could go high. Actually, projections of US debt in the next few years look like it's kind of solidly tailed off. But really, the question is, are people going to lose faith in the dollar? I mean, I'm not sure that's going to happen in my lifetime.
Where else are we going?
Podcasts will be largely irrelevant because it's the global reserve currency. Yeah. Yeah. So I think the you can, I think, apply that also to the euro. And what was interesting about the whole Liz Truss thing was that actually briefly it looked like people were going to lose faith in sterling. I don't think necessarily it would have played out like that. But, again, so long as people have got faith in your underlying currency, your debt pile is generally manageable. You know, and again, there's lots of talk. Again, it's quite popular in the press, the talk about the demise of the dollar and will oil still settle in dollars and are the BRICS going to launch their own currency? And I just think most of it's nonsense, frankly.
I can always trade it in Bitcoin, add in an extra layer.
Isn't that Trump's idea?
Well, I mean, he's trying to get both sets of voters, isn't he?
Yeah. So I'm, and again, the dollar's it's come off a little bit the last couple of months, but generally you track back the dollar index, it's all near all-time highs.
Yeah.
Tells you that the global financial markets are kind of casting a blind eye a bit to US debt.
Agree. And then credit spreads. So the additional return one gets on investing in investment grade companies over governments. Sterling spreads are around 1.3, 1.4%. Does that sound about right?
Yep.
Over gilts, and US corporate bonds are yielding about 1.1%, just over 100 basis points. If you look on the chart, this chart goes back deliberately pre-financial crisis when we had to rescale the axis, but they're at the lower end of the long-term range, and obviously they do tend to rise when markets get concerned, or the 2015-2016 period here with the oil price collapse and we had a sort of mini recession, didn't we? Credit investors, do they look complacent at these sort of levels, or credit investors be okay here?
Yeah, again, I'm as my history, I'm generally more of an equities guy, but as you guys know, I lean quite heavily on some
bond guys.
In credit markets, both of whom very experienced and senior. They tell me right now that credit markets are becalmed, which is good news. But they do, I think at the margin, they think spreads could go higher, particularly if we're sailing into slower economic growth kind of waters. I think they're probably slightly more anxious at kind of above in investment grade spread, so moving up, towards junk. But I don't think they're expecting spreads to blow out. But I think if next year is going to be a stickier year for economic growth, that would be consistent with spreads widening somewhat, which I don't think necessarily would be alarming.
No.
It would be kind of more of a natural economic cycle, widening of spreads, than a kind of shock event, I think is the expectation.
But you do tend to get these blowouts in spreads. Yep. But over the long term, if you own corporate bonds over government, that additional premium that you get from investment-grade corporates tends to act in your favour over the medium to long term. So, you're harvesting the risk premium, aren't you? You just have to kind of make sure that you don't get carried out, I guess.
Yeah, and with those spikes. And again, one of the problems, obviously, looking at this chart back in the lead-up to the financial crisis, is that actually at the sovereign level, governments were pretty well-capitalised, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
But companies and people weren't. All the leverage was sat in banks and other corporates and in households. And really what you've seen, the whole purpose of QE and the approach of central bankers and really politicians in the 15 years since was to shift that leverage from companies and people up to the sovereign level. So what you've got right now is generally companies, corporates are way better capitalized than they were, you know, backheaded into the financial crisis, which is consistent with both tighter spreads and, you know, kind of, and with that, you know, more kind of security in the bonds that you're owning. And which is one of the reasons that this cycle is different, you know, in terms of everyone's reaction to interest rates.
Mm.
You just haven't got the leverage at the corporate or household level that you did.
Yeah.
In which case that transmission mechanism from higher rates is A, less, and B, takes longer.
Yeah. Well, if you're Microsoft or Apple, you've got net cash in your balance sheet anyway, so 5% rates are brilliant.
Yeah.
Adds to your bottom line in income, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Talking of Apple and Microsoft, what a really neat segue that is. 5-year chart here in the top, the US tech sector in blue versus the US market in yellow. And obviously one's gone up by more than the other. And then the bottom line, the green line here, is the relative, so one divided by the other. So when the green line's going up, that means that the tech sector is doing better than the wider market. And when it's going down, that means that the tech sector's underperforming the market. This is US-centric only.
Mm-hmm.
We can see, it's really interesting, lockdown period, 2020, most of 2021, the tech sector was outperforming. 2022, you know, reopening Ukraine, tech sector underperforms. And then 2023, 2024 in particular, ChatGPT, the kind of Daily Mail moment for AI, as our tech analyst called it, has seen tech go on a tear again. Sort of hints in markets in the last month, 2 months, that maybe it's kind of exhausting itself. Sort of strong views on that?
I think 2022 was a function of interest rates going from nothing to 5-6%. And of course, whenever you're dealing with growth companies, the big part of the valuation is discounting back future cash flow. So suddenly the way that you would value those companies, people were more concerned about. You know, I think fundamentally for me, everyone looks at the kind of the top down on US technology, but we're in the middle of a, you know, just an amazing period of innovation, technological advancement, and, you know, of which a lot of these companies are at the forefront of. You know, we can all debate valuation on an individual stock level, but, you know, for me, those dynamics haven't really changed. And again, AI, like every kind of new tech thing before it, will have its bubbles. You know, but I think fundamentally, in a global economy that's really struggling for growth, why would you not be reasonably well exposed to, you know, really innovative to those companies? Yeah, that's kind of the way that I look at it.
Mm-hmm. I've got a chart here, the big three, which you've had before, Nvidia in blue, Microsoft in yellow, and Apple in grey. See, Nvidia did very briefly for about a day or two, became the biggest stock in the world, didn't it? In fact, we noted it on the pod at the time, Hughesy, and thought maybe this was the top.
That's the time you bought it, PA.
I bought it, PA. Yeah, right at the top. No, friend of the pod, actually. friend of the pod, Dario Perkins. He actually did buy it at the top. He confessed in one of his notes a few weeks ago.
And he said he was very pleased because he wanted some balancing out and rotation. Didn't
he did. It's the only way he could do it, by buying some. But yeah, I mean, you touched on valuation on the tech sector, and the blue line here is a 12-month forward valuation indicator of the tech sector at 28 PE versus the wider market, which itself is on a pretty kind of, you'd say, relatively punchy multiple of 22 times. And again, that multiple implies already that the growth is going to come through over the next 12 months, which as we've discussed, it's not a done deal if the economy is slowing.
Yeah.
Is that the right premium, or do we?
I'd be more worried about the probably the market PE. Yeah. Frankly, you know, because I don't for the level of innovation that you're getting is somewhere between 20 and 25 and 30 times PE, particularly aggressive. I would argue not. I'd be more worried about the larger market. Although cyclicals haven't done well, you know, over the last 3 to 6 months as share prices, so may well already be discounting, you know, some earnings downgrades. That's where I probably have some more anxiety. But again, if you to put this in context, again, if you look at it from a kind of UK and a European perspective, just in terms of the scarcity value of these companies, I was, I don't know whether you saw yesterday, but Mario Draghi has published his big report on how to improve European competitiveness. And I think there, I've not read it, I was reading headlines. Some of it looked curious, other bits of it looked interesting, you know, but I think there's a great stat that there's no EU company with a market cap over $100 billion dollars that's been founded in the last 50 years. Whereas there's six US companies with market caps over $1 trillion that have been founded more recently than that. So when you put it in that context, you know, the scarcity value of these businesses globally and the kind of level of innovation, where else are you going to kind of find that? It's difficult actually in Europe. I think there's some great businesses in the, very innovative businesses in the UK, you know, probably further down the market cap spectrum. But in terms of those bellwether, big technology innovators, it's kind of these. And I think you can't underestimate, you know, the scarcity value here as well.
Well, all those businesses, those US tech, trillion dollar tech businesses that you mentioned, you know, they've all had founder owners who've continued to stay in.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of, you know, my observation doing what we do in particular and looking at the UK is that UK startups, entrepreneurs, they get to, let's just say they take their business to 5 to 10 million.
Yeah.
And they're 50, 60, and they go, do you know what? I think I've had enough now. I think I'm going to boost up and I'm going to sell to private equity or to a consolidator or whoever. Whereas, you know, Zuckerberg, they've gone, do you know what? I don't want $10 million. I'm going to take this to 100 million.
Yeah, obviously with your investment banking hat on, and I don't know, you know, in terms of listings and secondary raisings and things, I don't know how hands-on you are on that, but what do you think the difference is between UK owners and US owners, where a US owner is, you know, I want to grow the business to that mega size, and in the UK, as John says, it's actually I can retire on this and have quite a nice life.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you back up a level, you know, we can all, you know, it's the presidential election debate tonight. We can all look at US politics and parts of US culture and scratch our heads. But fundamentally, the capital markets that they've evolved are just off the charts better as a general rule than anywhere else in the world in terms of availability of capital to fund businesses, their willingness to kill dead capital rather than preserve businesses that you know necessarily shouldn't still be around. So this whole kind of creative destruction thing, which again breathes oxygen, you know, into the whole kind of the whole entrepreneurial nature of how the US goes about funding and building businesses. I think it's, you know, again, you can I would pivot slightly away from technology. The UK's founded some great tech businesses in the last 20 years, Arm and others, but actually in science, and I hope this is something that the new government addresses in the UK, it is just way easier to fund new science in the US than it is anywhere in Europe, just because of the pools of capital, the specialist biotech venture funds that exist over there, who are used to risking money, losing money, but then fundamentally making money by playing that longer game. So I think if you're a founder in the US, just the addressable pools of capital you can tap at every stage of your growth are bigger and probably more liquid. And I think this is a challenge for the UK. You know, there's already been, I think, some really interesting, you know, credit, Julia Hoggett, the stock exchange, the FCA changes that they're announcing, the Mansion House reforms, the direction of travel now in the UK is definitely, I think, in the right direction. I think there's a lot more they can do because we need to make sure standalone that we're never going to be the US, but that we have got both private and public capital markets that support UK innovation, where people don't have to feel like they've got to go to the US. And I think, you know, the work there has begun, actually, I think, and the UK is ahead of Europe on this quite significantly right now. But there's a huge amount more, I think, the regulators and administrators and the government can do. And if, again, I think it's a good test of Rachel Reeves and Keir Starmer, if they're serious about growth.
Well, they spent their campaign talking about growth, didn't they? So it's about time.
Yeah, you've got to pull some levers that mean that we're attracting overseas capital, and that our capital markets aren't just functioning, you know, but they're, you know, but they're healthy.
Mm.
And I, again, I think this is something that, that the US has just done brilliantly through the kind of decades, frankly, which is how you end up with, you know, the, you're pairing the best global innovation. There's no reason that Microsoft and Google and Facebook and all of these companies should have emerged from the US. They did, because you're pairing intellectual property that's off the charts with hugely deep capital markets and a risk appetite to fund it. It's kind of that simple.
Do you think it comes down to, is it just the UK or a bit, you know, people a bit more risk averse, or is it regulations too tight to allow individual investors or almost, you know, more PE funds to exist or VCT funds? Because the regulatory environment is obviously tougher here than in the US. It's I think in the UK it's almost becoming, as an investor, you cannot lose money, and if you do lose money, there's a case to claim something. It feels
tricky. I mean, I think the UK for me always sits on most things between the US and Europe, as in the EU, because there's lots of stuff in the UK you could look at and feel like that could do with, you know, reform. But then you compare it to some aspects of what goes on in Europe, and you think, well, all right, you know, we're all, you know, we're kind of somewhere between the two.
Yeah.
We've got great science hubs. We have got some really good PE companies here. We are still the hub in Europe, despite Brexit, in terms of funding, you know, new technology, fintech, new science. But, you know, I think there's, so I think from a relative perspective across Europe, I think the UK is well positioned, and it's never going to be the US, but on various levels, there's more that I think.
I think it's good to hear that we're, you know, in the middle still, and there is still a view of the UK being sort of we're doing it better than Europe.
Yeah, again, all you read about in the press is there's no UK IPOs, everyone's delisting, everyone's going to the US. It's still the busiest capital market in Europe by a delta.
Yeah.
Privately and publicly, it is every year. It has been since Brexit. Could it, you know, did Brexit in and all the various layers of regulation, has it impacted UK public markets particularly? Yes. And that's why I'm, again, it's encouraging to see. It's not often that you get a uniformity, you know, across administrators, regulators and politicians. But this change agenda in the UK, what can we do to help funding markets, to help public markets? It feels like everyone's on the same page. I'm led to believe that the new government are also. We'll see what they do. You know, so the levers are being pulled, whether it's listing rules. You know, there's obviously stuff that can be done in terms of pension funds and allocation to UK. There's more incentives, you know, that they could establish. Let's see. But I think we reached maximum kind of bearishness on the UK, it felt to me, about 12 months ago. And it was beginning to drive me a bit crazy, because you couldn't find anyone constructive on the UK pretty much anywhere at all. As I say, I think that narrative's changing for good reason, and hopefully will continue to.
Good. But I think we'll leave it there on that.
Sort of, we're probably going for hours, but you've got better things to do these days.
That's great. Well, we started out in Chicago, went to Hamburg, spent a bit of time in London, China, France, US, Silicon Valley. So that's been really interesting.
Perfect,
Thank you for your time, Dave.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's hugely appreciated.
Thank you to all for watching and listening. And any questions, let us know. Jonathan.Raymond@quarterachieveit.com. And we hope to see you next time. Thanks very much.